So thank you to both speakers for very rich presentations, very remarkable archives and implied and spoken theory that challenges, I think, really a whole sense of the human sensorium, actually. I'm going to go out that far. I think this is a very, very rich work. So that's probably the real title of the panel, as we discovered. So remember the protocol. You need to get a mic so that the people who are live streaming or who later watch the recording can hear your question. We have a decent amount of time for questions, so I'm just going to kick it open to whoever would like to begin.
Students, yeah.
Students again, isn't it?
Sorry?
The students again, isn't it?
Yeah.
Thank you. And thank you both for wonderfully illuminating papers. We have a couple of questions. Clearly, is this on? Yes? Okay. Clearly, issues pertinent to identity, social and political representation or recognition, and post-coloniality are central to both of your work. We were hoping you might say something about what strategies you identify, strategies perhaps external to traditional modes of academic production, as productive tools for engaging with the continuing legacies of colonial modernity. The varied legacies of settlers and structures of colonialism mean processes of decolonization must grapple with specific context. However, to add to this first question, might you be willing to say something or comment on the potentialities of forging or thinking transnational alliances? Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Just start.
We'll have a go at that.
Do you want to start?
No, you start.
Oh, I start. Okay. I think my in terms of strategies, I think my main concern, the main concern of my engagement with sound recordings, is to maybe move a little bit what our idea of the colonial archive, of what we think we have, because we have like a huge amount of recordings that haven't appeared anywhere. I mean, there's a lot of theorizing about, you know, like, I mean, I've been working in South Africa for 6 years, and there it is very important to theorize this archive, because after apartheid, what histories do you write? How can you write histories with this material, you know, like with material in which, you know, that has been produced in a specific way, and in which the voice, and that's not the acoustic voice, of the people does not appear, right? So what do you do with these recordings? And at the moment, I'm trying to grapple with this. I'm trying to see how we can strategically move them into the attention of scholars, because what really is needed is more people working on this, because this is very time consuming. I mean, you have to. I think the big difference between the sound archive and the photographic archive is you don't open the drawer and then you see something. You open a drawer and then you have recordings, and then you have to digitize them, and then you have to record them, and and translate them. It's a different process, right? To get to what's actually on them. And I think the interesting thing is that you have a lot of critique that's not post-colonial critique, but it's colonial critique. It's people in a colonial situation uttering criticism then and there. And that's very unusual. That's the one thing. And the other thing is, of course, you have, like, because you were addressing modernity, of course you have, like, these interesting assumptions you find in the writing of the recordists. There's always this idea, you bring the phonograph somewhere and then the savage is scared, you know, like, and they are afraid to lose their shadow or whatever they're going to lose. Actually, there has been a record industry in East Africa and India very early, you know, like, and people knew. I mean, the prisoners of war, especially the Indian prisoners of war, I think they were very aware of, like, what this recording process was. And in some cases, they were actually speaking petitions, because they knew what was recorded would go out. They didn't know how it would, where it would go, who would get it, but there is petitioning there. So there is also a completely new and interesting catalogue of strategies from the side of the people who were actually recorded. And this is something that you find in several recording situations. I don't know if you if that answers your question.
No, it's a very, very rich question, I think. I think part of the work that I'm doing with what we generally call national cinemas, in this case Iranian cinema, is to show that the national category is something that has been manufactured out of the circulation of films in international film festivals. The way to label a film is to associate it in some way with the national and to ground it that way.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas I think that the history of film and the history of film industries show that the production of film industries around the world is always associated, almost always, associated with territorial expansion, whether it's colonialism or imperialism or the quest for oil in the case of Iran. So the British were interested in oil, and they were interested in justifying their presence in Iran. They hired technicians. They created an industry. And out of that and the American interest in oil in Iran, a film industry was produced that now is incredibly prosperous and seemingly national. Right. So it's not only the industry, but also the forms, the codes and conventions of cinema that are informed by transnational, international practices in film. They're modified certainly by national laws, and I think that's what makes Iranian post-revolutionary cinema interesting, because it's sort of informed by the Islamic theocracy's set of rules and regulations around modesty. But on a very basic level, it speaks to the codes and conventions that are recognizable by an international audience. But the project, you know, that I'm envisioning this paper fitting into is also one that opens up Iran's borders and shows the linkages that it has to other places. For example, the project on Iranian slavery, which very little is known and written about, and more importantly, the effect of the odd and intriguing traditions that we see in contemporary Iranian films, dances, music, scenes of spirit possession that have their roots in that history of slavery. Right. So I think that's what I have to say about
that. Could I add one sentence on the transnational? I think what is interesting is that these histories that you find, these archives are transnational in itself, and the histories that you find run these loops. So colonialism always also means that you can't disentangle the countries from each other, from their colonial engagement. So I've been asked several times in South Africa, especially with the project that I'd done before that, why are you doing this? What is this? And I said, well, it's also my history. You know, that's as much my history as it is yours. Yeah.
And I would also say that the whole discussion of light and cinema and architecture, it comes out of an understanding of how cinema gives form to light and how sacred architecture, especially in the context of Islam, gives form to light. But I think that the results of this discussion are universal. I mean, if you are going to go to the cinema as a spiritual practice, it's really relevant to anyone that's becoming conscious of your presence and absence in every instant.
So, second student question. No, okay. So now it's I'm waking up very slowly this morning.
Fantastic presentations. Thank you so much, Annette. I immediately was thinking about, you know, I flashed to yesterday and Karin's discussion about the modes of listening of the totalitarian.
Yes.
And so immediately as you were sort of unpacking these tensions and ruptures between the recording and then the way that the recordings were being heard, to begin to conceptualize what is the colonialist mode of listening. I think super provocative and would love to dig deeper into that further. Actually, my question for Nagard is on the film. I so appreciated your reflections and allowing us to see the clips and to experience the clips as you were unpacking them. And I was reminded when you invoked Walter Benjamin, as my memory serves me correctly, early in the essay, Benjamin talks about the auratic in relationship to the gramophone. Mm-hmm. And so as the clips were playing, you showed us two, I was asking myself, what is the sound of light? And it was remarkable that, I don't know if this is just accidental, but in both clips, the moment when Paddy moves into this disassembling ecstatic experience in both clips, it's prefigured by the sound of a door closing and a completely unnaturally extended reverb that does not end. When is that thing going to end? And so the kind of erratic of the reverberation of the spaces seems to have this curious parallel to the kind of light you're talking about. So I suspect my question to you is, what happens to our notion of spirituality when we only see light and we don't hear it?
You start.
Again? I'm thinking.
It sounds like the kind of thing we should all be meditating on for maybe to take like.
Could you think a bit and start?
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
I've been grappling with this, with the kind of listening for a while, and I mean, of course, people have been writing on the native informant, and the status of the native informant. In the situation of the camps, it really is, one really has to see the researchers positioned towards the camps as that towards a repository. Oh, great. Here we can record all the languages that we always were interested. So, as I said, for instance, you have, for instance, a lot of recordings in languages from Madagascar and the Comoros, not because there were so many soldiers from Madagascar and the Comoros, but because someone wanted to write his dissertation on it. So you have like Swahili speakers who don't get recorded because Swahili was already well documented. You have like the small languages, of course, with which I then struggle to find a translator for. You know, like for me, this is very difficult. It's like you have these camps and they are repositories for research. So they go there, the linguists and the musicologists, and they record, but then also measurements were made and all kinds of things happens at the camps, right? And as I said yesterday with regard to Karen's presentation, they also produced palatogramma, like casts of the inside of the mouth, the x-rays were made, all kinds of things. And the semantics of the recordings did not play a role at all, and you can see that if you look, for instance, in the grammar of Maria von Tilling, where I found Mohammed Noor, you have like example sentences that say nobody will want to go to the next war, or it's very cold here, things like that. You know, like where you just think, okay. And then you have his life story, but it's not about social history. It's about the flow of a language. And I call this as extractive listening. It's a listening that draws out something very specific and is not interested in anything else. So I think with a paradigmatic shift, with a different way of listening, you can get out a lot from these recordings. And you don't only listen to the person who was recorded, because usually you also have the acoustic tag, right, where someone like Lichtenegger, on whom I worked before, says, der Dammerer Hanep erzählt eine Geschichte, you know, like very German, like you hear him recording himself. So there's a lot of like a colonial encounter that has been acoustically registered. And yeah, we have to find a different way of listening. And I think it's a kind of close listening, where you listen to everything, like really everything, like the acoustic tag. Maybe you hear something in the background, as you said. Sometimes you can hear sounds in the room, not so well when the recordings were done with a phonograph, because phonographs really register only that which happens really in front of them. Everything that's further in the back, you don't hear. That's why in the first image, Dürgen holds the man in the neck, because he wants to have like the perfect distance to the funnel. So there's not much ambient sound, but there is still stuff. Sometimes you hear someone whisper, and you know, like there's a lot of things that you can get out of it if you go away from extractive listening to another kind of listening. Yeah.
I want to also answer the question in terms of a different kind of listening. I think that presenting my work, I always come to remember again that I'm not really talking so much about representation. So it's not really about seeing the light necessarily, but being engulfed in it. And I actually see film as a somatic inscription on the body. So as this light is inscribed on the body, so is the sound. And I think that's the way that I think spirituality also works in relation to sound and film. And it is about, I think, this particular project is about the entrainment in light, the entrainment of the entire body.
That's beautiful. Thank you.
Thank you very much. My name is Leila Parsons. I teach at McGill in Islamic Studies. These were wonderful presentations. I have a question for Professor Hoffman about these recordings, which have made my kind of heartbeat fast, because they're so poignant. And I think you know, what you just talked about the fact that these are projections of messages, either to not be moved to Romania or to participate in a debate that's going on in Somalia, and trying to think about the kind of choices that these men must have been discussing about how to use this possibility of projection out from imprisonment. Obviously, that's going to be impossible to access. I mean, that's lost, right? Those discussions about use of this moment. But I think the critique of colonial listening is incredibly important, obviously. But there's something so powerful about the juxtaposition between the colonial attention to form and your now attention to content, or the kind of historian's attention to content, that's really bringing for us a series of appeals in different contexts that makes me not want to hear too much about colonial listening, but more about what these messages are actually saying to us.
Thank you. I can relate to this completely. In the first project that I did on sound recordings of that kind, I was so intrigued by what people were actually saying that I couldn't really pay too much attention of like how it was produced. But you have to, because that's quite an important part of it. That's an important part because it kind of creates a grid of what is possible. And you have to know what this grid is, because otherwise you don't understand what's happening. it's not always impossible, I think, to get hold of the discussions. And I give you a little story that's related to that. Unfortunately, I only realized that when I already had done my exhibition. It was too late. But the last set of recordings before these ones, I was working on the recordings of a German man who called himself an artist, and he went to Namibia and did live casts of faces and hands and stuff for an archive of races. But he also recorded people because he was commissioned by the Phonogram Archive in Berlin because they wanted so-called Bushman songs and stuff. He didn't record any Bushman songs, but what he recorded went to the archive anyway. And now there, in the beginning, he was on a farm, and he tests his equipment because he doesn't really know how the phonograph and how all this stuff is going to work. Not if he works it not in a closed room, right? So he does all kinds of test recordings, which gives the farm workers the possibility to have themselves recorded, and they actually seem to like it. So there are several people who have themselves recorded. And you have to, in this situation, you have to imagine a group of people being recorded at the same time. So they were talking to each other as well. They were not so much talking to the man who was recording them because he wouldn't understand them, because they were speaking Ojihedero and Nama. But they were speaking to each other. So the first, there's the story of the jackal and the sun recorded by a man who speaks Nama. And in this story, the jackal falls in love with the sun and carries her on his back. But the sun scorches his back. And then he tries to get rid of her, and he wiggles and does all kinds of things, but he can't shake her off, right? And in the end, the sun wins and he can't shake her off. And then an Ojihedero speaker tells the same story with a different end, in which the sun actually can be shaken off. And then later I found that in letters of Hendrik Witboy, who was like a very important anti-colonial warrior in Namibia at the time, that he compares colonialism with carrying the sun on your back. So these men were talking to each other. One gives this end where, okay, well, we can't shake them off, and the other one says, well, maybe we can. So it does happen, but you need a lot of attention to detail. You need to find out who was in the recording situation, who could have spoken to whom. Like with the prisoners of war, I know that they were taken to recording studios sometimes. Most of the recordings were done in the camps, but sometimes they went to recording studios, and then there were several men. Now, did they speak to each other? Could they understand each other? Did they have like a common lingua franca? These are the things you need to find out. Yeah.
These are very beautiful. Okay, we're going to have one last question from the person in the back there. We started a little late, so we'll run over a little bit.
It's a good question. Does that work? Yeah. So it's a question for Nigar. I was wondering, you've been quoting Le Corbusier, who is a very important theorist of modernism in architecture. And I think, he has a very strong conception of architecture, which I believe could be argued as being almost religious or at least very dogmatic. And I was wondering if you could maybe elaborate on how Le Corbusier's conception of architecture as almost a spiritual practice applies to your work.
Well, I found him useful because I was talking, I was trying to figure out how to, the question that was posed to me, which started this entire project, was what is the relationship between Islamic spirituality and cinema? And I was like, this is not what I do. And that's how I started sorting out the question. And the way that I started was through architecture. What is it about sacred architecture that connects the Muslim believer to the divine? And the answers came through various theoreticians of architecture that dealt with this question, and I think Le Corbusier was one of them. So that's how he really plays into it. It's really about, and what I found was that it was that it was about the form-giving qualities of architecture. It's the way that architecture gives form and shape to light and puts us in relation to that. So that's really, really how my relationship to Le Corbusier developed.
So I think we need to call a halt at this point just because people will need coffee and we need to get back on. I want to thank both our presenters for a remarkable presentation.